And right now, with Valentine's Day approaching, our thoughts turn to flowers and chocolates, votive candles, romantic dinners, love, passion, and, well, let's be honest, lust. Lust has always been the shadowy stepchild in the family of romantic emotions, shadowy enough to earn a place among the seven deadly sins. If you've done some thinking about lust, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email is totn@npr.org. Joining us now, Simon Blackburn, author of A Slim Volume on Lust, published by Oxford University Press as part of its Seven Deadly Sins series. He's the professor of philosophy at Cambridge University in Cambridge, England, and he's on the phone from his office there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You promise early on in this book to try to speak up for lust. Does lust need a defender?
Well, I think it probably does. I try to clean it off a bit and present it with a nice, shiny, grinning face, whereas it's usually presented as a kind of disreputable relative of the nice things that you talked about. So, yes, I guess I felt it needed a defense, and I tried to provide it.
You point out quite rightly that lust is, after all, essential to life. How did it get such a bad rep?
Well, obviously it needs, it generates worry. I think, certainly in the Western tradition, I don't think there's been a society which wasn't anxious about it, but that anxiety can take various forms. Anxious about, you know, misdirected lust that's directed to the wrong people in the wrong place, wrong time. But the prevailing mood became so glum and gloomy, especially under Christianity, although arguably before that. And I felt that it was worth revisiting the tradition, at least to see whether that glum and gloom could be removed a bit.
Can you walk us somewhat through the Western tradition of saddling lust with this
shame I'm afraid and anxiety? It's not really a confessions book. It's not a professor tells all. It's quite quite historical and quite philosophical, but I think entertaining for all that.
So from the beginning, from the classicists in the beginning, what was their take?
Well, it's quite interesting. They're very matter of fact, but as I read it, there's anxiety in the air. I mean, one of the nice ways of seeing that is with the half human, half goat form, the satyr, as it's called, who is often pictured doing rather naughty things. And the Greeks obviously liked that. They had fun looking at those pictures. They come everywhere. But the fact that it's half human, half goat suggests that there's a kind of distancing. They're not entirely happy with the idea that this is humanity doing it itself. It's as if half of you's been overtaken by the animal. And of course that's the side of it that gets emphasized both in Stoicism in the Roman world and then in the Christian world.
You talk about lust as being a state of nature and a state of mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, desires, I define lust in terms of the aroused or excited desire, a desire that floods the body, and the body therefore has to be present, but the desire is a mental state. You want something, and of course part of the interest about lust is it's not clear what people want, and I take some time, say, sort of trying to disprove various bad shots at saying what it wants, like it wants a terminus, it wants an orgasm, say. I don't think that's true. It wants the pleasures of sexual relationships, and it's a question of what those pleasures are.
Kind of chases itself in a way.
Yes. The one image that I'm quite anxious not to, as it were, disprove, but at least to displace from the center of things, is the idea of it as purely selfish, as if you just want your own gratification, you don't care about the other person. I quote the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who has this wonderful description of lust as the desire and the knowledge that you're giving pleasure to another, and that's the kind of catalyst for a kind of ascending ladder of pleasure. And that's like making music or making conversation, which are not selfish pleasures. They're pleasures that we create together. And I wanted to emphasize that side of it, which, of course, it's very I'm not rose-tinted enough to think that's the only side of it, but it's the central side, I think.
We are talking about lust, one of the seven deadly sins. We're going to take a call from Gavin in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Gavin.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I'm a 10th grade English teacher who's right now trying to teach kids Dante's Inferno, and there's nothing like the second circle of lust to get kids interested in literature.
Yes. Yes, well, Paolo and Francesca, I'm afraid, got lost on the cutting room floor. They were in a first draft of my little book. It was very circumscribed for space. That's a wonderful description, and of course the idea that they're eternally buffeted around, that there's no release from this, is very interesting. And it comes again, I do quote the English poet Dryden, who has the same idea and expresses it quite wonderfully. I quote a big poem of his. It was touch and go whether Dante stayed in and Dryden went, but it's the same idea. Yes, it's a great piece of description.
It's interesting that 15 and 16 year olds can connect with that topic rather quickly, while some of the other things we read doesn't do it for them.
That's right. Well, some of the sins in Purgatory, in the Inferno, are fairly fairly local. There's some kind of Italian politics in there. But Paolo and Francesca are universal, aren't they?
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Gavin.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take one more call from Susie in San Francisco. Hi, Susie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My comment about lust was basically that I think that it arises out of our desires, and it's a part of our sexuality. And basically, lust is essential to our nature. And I think sin is really more our choice.
Yeah.
And if you add a simple equation, which is sort of hormones plus desire plus imagination, you're going to get something akin to lust.
Yep.
And I think it's difficult for a coupling to occur without something, attraction and the chemistry and things like that.
I think that's a point that you made, Simon Blackburn, right at the beginning of your book, that it is essential. Is it a misnomer to call it one of the seven deadly sins? Is deadly too strong a word for lust?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's certainly deadly, and I think actually sin, as your caller, I'm afraid I didn't catch your name, but as you point out, I mean, I would say that it would be a sin to have a coupling without it. I mean, unless there's lust on both sides, then one side is arguably manipulating or exploiting or taking advantage of the other. So, in fact, I think lust actually makes sex okay. and that's part of what's wrong with all sorts of perversions like pedophilia or prostitution.
Is it interchangeable or not interchangeable with sex, passion, desire, love?
Well, it is the desire, as I'm describing, it's the desire for the pleasures of sexual activity with somebody. And so it can be there without love, I'm afraid. A lot of moralists wish that it couldn't be, but it can. And love can be there without lust. You might be too tired or too old or too ill or all sorts of things. And that can be very mortifying as well. So, don't knock it while you've got it.
All right, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Simon Blackburn is the author of Lust, part of the Seven Deadly Sins series, which is produced by Oxford Press and the New York Public Library, and he is the professor of philosophy at Cambridge University. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.